Okay, ברוכים הבאים, ערב טוב. Today we're going to touch a light subject. Nah, death was just a prelude. I mean, there's extra light. It doesn't exist, so we can move on to serious business. Today we're going to touch the concepts of Messiah versus Messianic era. As we usually do. Ah, I was just making a point that I was missing my bouquet of flowers. There you go. Now I feel really at home. And before we start touching the actual subject matter, I would like to give you a brief context about the way the relationship between God and man, and mankind, not men, male, but mankind, is understood in Jewish discourse. And if we had to kind of encapsulate it in three major terms, I would borrow from Franz Rosenzweig's Star of Redemption, and I will use the three terms that he uses there. The first one is creation, the second one is revelation, and the third one is redemption. You know what, we'll do this. I guess that there are some people who want to write down, right? And you don't have any. So let's start. We'll bring more copies in a few minutes, but you can start writing on this if you like. These are the sources for today's class. Now let us understand, when we talk about creation, and this is just a free association. When we talk about creation, what do you get from that? What do you mean when we say creation? The creation of the world, right? The beginning, Bereshit bara Elohim et hashamayim et haaretz. When we talk about revelation, what are we talking about?
Har Sinai.
Har Sinai, usually understood revelation with an uppercase R. And when we're talking about redemption, what are we talking about? Usually people talk about Biata Mashiach, and so on and so forth, right? So we have the creation of the world, we have Matan Torah, the giving of Torah at Sinai, and we talk about Biata Mashiach, the arrival of the Messiah. We have more copies in a minute. Let us unpack that a little bit before we move on, because obviously what you just said is a very, very preliminary, rudimentary level of understanding creation, revelation, and redemption. First of all, when we talk about creation, we talk about two levels of understanding creation. The first one, which is more basic, and you alluded to that, is the creation of the world as we understand it. The world was created, and since that moment we start reading what happened in the world, right? And then into this creation, the world of revelation is infused at a certain point, at a certain juncture in history. So there is some sort of a linear evolution from creation to revelation. However, creation can be understood in another way. If you remember, last week I told you that the first verse of the Torah should not only be read on the simple level of in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, you remember that? But I also told you we should also, in order to understand the concept that I was trying to introduce last week, understand that the world, or that if we want to understand creation, is that the world is God in creation. That it's not that in the beginning God created the world, in other words, that there is no real separation between the creator and the created, but rather that the world is a divinity in creation. Did you understand the difference?
No.
So I'll explain. It's not as if I'm drawing a painting and you say, okay, so obviously there's something of you in that painting and blah, 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 and we can have a whole philosophical discourse about what's the distinction between the author and what the author wrote or what the author or what I just did here. In other words, that there's a separation between me as a creator and the painting as a created. Imagine that now I take myself as a potential, not like me, right? And I actually appear to you in form of the painting. So now obviously there's no, I am the painting, right? In other words, the world is God in creation. Did you follow what I just say? Yes, no? Okay, now, if the world is part of creation, in other words, the world is God in creation, and mankind is part of the created world, ergo, mankind is part of God. And therefore, mankind has all the intrinsic, inherent property to discover God. Did you follow so far? Don't be shy. Yes, no, shall I take a step back again?
Why does that follow? Why not man, if man is part of God, then man, and man has all of those characteristics, so man is God-like.
Yeah, little, a small God. Olam katan, a small world, a small God. Va'achsiro, as the book says, va'achsiro me'at me'elohim. Man is understood as created betzelem Elohim. Betzelem Elohim, in the image of God, in the simple sense. But what I'm trying to show you here is that from this rendition of creation, mankind is an inherent component of divinity. And as such, has all the properties already inherent to man to understand divinity. In that respect, and this is where I'm trying to get you, I just made a distinction between creation and revelation, right? From the second model of the world is God in creation and mankind is part of that created world, the act of creation according to that model is already a revelation of God. Did you follow? Again.
So aren't science or revelation?
Well, there's nothing that is not. Look guys, when we're talking about creation, revelation and redemption, we talk about one model where we talk about the creation of the world. Revelation is Sinai. And redemption is the Messiah, Biyat HaMashiach. This is one model that usually people understand, creation, revelation, and redemption. I'm talking about a second model. And we have to understand the distinction between them. Otherwise, we cannot understand the evolution of the discussion between Messiah and Messianic era. The second model comes and says that creation is in and of itself a revelation of divinity. You follow what I'm saying? God appearing in the existing realm, speaking of last week, from the being to the existing. In other words, creation equals revelation itself. God is revealed through the act of creation. Yes?
Creation is revelation.
Hmm?
Creation is revelation.
Creation is revelation. And then, when we talk about revelation here, it's no longer a revelation of God, it's a revelation of God's desire, a revelation of God's charge, a revelation of what does God want from us, and so on and so forth. In other words, here we're talking already about what does God want from us as part of God above, as a revealed property that we are part of, right? We are part of God. What would you say about redemption in this model? Think about what is the one thing that is intrinsic to each one of those two. Here and here, mankind is an inherent part of the process. Mm-hmm. You follow?
Mm-hmm.
If mankind is an inherent part of the process, mankind should be an inherent part of the redemptive process as well. So we should ask ourselves, what does that mean? Mankind leads.
Mankind what?
Mankind leads. Leads the way. This is the context for our entire discussions today. Did you follow what I just said about these two models?
Does that add up to Tikkun Olam?
Yes.
Well, it has ramifications about everything.
Where did this model come from? The second model.
I'll show you right there. In the same text, of the same prophet, one verse after the other, the two models, they are completely far away from one another, within the same prophet. I'll show you. So let me ask you, first of all, a very, very simple question. Redemption of the second model?
Yes.
All I said so far is that in the second model, you have mankind as an inherent or an intrinsic component to both levels. Which means that mankind has to be intrinsic to the third level. I haven't told you yet what it is. I'm just saying that it is mankind that leads this model rather than, I'm not telling you what this is, we'll just call him a Messiah and now we can start the course, the session. Okay? So let me ask you, what, not who, what is a Messiah? Mashiach, what is it? By the way, it's not a trick question. No, really, it's not a trick question. What is the word Mashiach? What does it mean? It appears in the Bible. What does it mean?
Savior of mankind.
No. Okay. Don't be, guys, it's not a trick question. What does the word Mashiach mean? Literally, what does it mean?
Messenger.
Anointed, right? Anointed by what? Not by whom, by what? Anointed by what?
Oil.
Oil. Do you know the word anointment, Mishcha? When you put Mishcha on your head, if you have that something, you put Mishcha on, right? Mm-hmm. What is Limshoach? To anoint. Right? What do you anoint in the Bible? Eh? Shemen. If you ever read Kinat David, the wailing song of David over Shaul and Yonatan, he calls Shaul Mashiach Bashamen. He was anointed with oil. Okay? Now let me ask you, what do you think is the reason for that kind of a custom? Why to anoint someone with oil? As part of what?
Purity.
Albeit I could tell you that within Jewish customs, definitely as they had translated also later to Christianity, it is usually water that associates with purity. But okay, that could be definitely a possibility. What else? Think about the properties of oil. And here you have a clue with my delinquent artistic talent. When you anoint someone with oil, what happens to them? What does oil do?
It remains there,
that's for sure. What else happens? Think about it, literally, think about it. You put,
It's greasy.
It seeps into, absorb, very nice. What else?
Makes you soft and shiny.
Makes you soft, okay, soft. But the second word is more interesting to me. Shiny. It reflects. Oil has reflective properties. If you know, it shines, it reflects, right?
Mm-hmm.
It reflects. Now think about the notion here, and I want to take you here to the ancient world, but also to the conceptual realm of those in the biblical narrative who were appointed as the people or the intermediaries between God and mankind. And I wrote men and women to say mankind in its entirety. When you have now the Mashiach, whose head is anointed with oil, his head points upwards. He is now reflecting, literally. He reflects the light that comes from above. He is anointed by divinity. The fact that the prophet anoints him is just a symbolic act. What happens here? He anoints him. So this man now, his head reflects the divine will.
But the kings were anointed.
And in a minute we'll see in a minute. But it doesn't have to be an anointment. Here king is anointed in order to reflect that kind of level. And from this point on, he now rules over mankind. Okay, so he negotiates the vertical level with the horizontal level.
He's
a Mashiach. Shaul was a Mashiach. Shaul is called Mashiach. Melech Mashiach. Guys, forget now about what you think you know about the term. I'm asking you now about the origin of the term. The origin of the term is a king who was anointed as a king in ancient Israel. He's now reflecting God, and he's now taking this authority that was bestowed upon him with this act of anointment, and he's now working on the horizontal level. I'll give you another example. The Kohen Gadol, the high priest. Anybody remembers the laws pertaining to the high priest's garment? It's one of the more boring parashot, so probably most people don't remember them. So he has, the Kohen Gadol has the vest, right? Ah, mitzuyan. The Kohen Gadol is the vest that has the Avnei HaChoshen, they are called. Each stone represents
a tribe.
Very, very nice. Now, where are they located?
In the breast.
Ah, that's it? You see?
Close to the heart.
Huh? Where?
Close to the heart.
Close to the heart, 12 of them. But there's another location that for some reason most people don't, huh? Ah, very nice. The Kohen Gadol has 12 here, 6 here, and 6 here.
The same stone?
Same stone. Why? These here are seen by man. These here are seen by God. Again, exactly the same model. A negotiator of divinity with mankind. The vertical model with the horizontal. This way, he is able to represent God's will on us. Okay? Okay? The same thing is a prophet. And by the way, if we're talking about the Kohen, does anybody know today who wears the exact same garment as the Kohen Gadol?
Oh,
no. No. Okay, it was a misleading question. What? Not who. What wears the same garment as the Kohen Gadol?
Funny that soldiers have...
The dargot here?
Yeah,
well, they should have the dargot here as well.
Yeah.
But any idea? Guys, next time you're in a synagogue, witness opening of the ark and see what the Torah wears.
Wow. Yes, of course.
The Torah wears the garment of the Kohen Gadol. It has the belt, it has the crowns, it has everything. All right? So the Kohen Gadol now, and by the way, it's a whole other lecture, why was the Kohen Gadol transferred into the Torah, but that's the movement from the temple era after the destruction to the rabbinic era, so that's a different lecture. But what I want you to remember now is that these people who understood or are appointed as kings, prophets, Kohanim, all those who negotiate the world of God with the world of men, were seen as negotiating the vertical with the horizontal. The king, as a Mashiach, was no different. Was no different. He was seen, and unfortunately it's always a he, just as it is with a Kohen Gadol. But luckily for us, it's not always like that with prophets. We also had 4 female prophets. But they are the negotiators of God and men. So, first of all, it is important to remember that the Mashiach is first, foremost, and ultimately, and that's very important to remember, a human being. And never transcends...
Just because he was a human being here, he will always be a human being?
He's perceived as a human being. The Mashiach, I'm talking about the origin of the term. Forget about, you're running very, very fast.
Yeah.
We have to start somewhere.
Another question.
Yeah.
You say the Mashiach, that's Hayyidiyah, but you're saying that a lot of people are Mashiach.
Not a lot. I mean, the kings, were Mashiachim.
They were. So it's not the Mashiach.
Wait, the Mashiach is a completely different story, which we'll get to. Okay? What I want is, first of all, to understand is the concept of kingship. And the idea of a king subject to God, and therefore under the rule of God at every given moment. Don't forget that the anointment of the king was also a message to the king. You are under supervision all the time. I see you. Your actions reflect on me. So make sure you know what you do. It's a very interesting symbolic act. Okay? A human being.
By the way, was this a practice in other ancient civilizations at the same time?
Very, very good question. We definitely know that priests from ancient civilizations such as ancient Egypt and others used to be anointed. Absolutely. But we don't necessarily know if it was for that specific reason. But there are a lot of parallels between ancient Hebrew and Judaic customs and the world from which they came. By the way, circumcision is one of them. If you already asked. In the ancient world, one of the ways to get sovereignty over another nation, and by the way, in some tribes, from what I understand, it's even practiced today, in some remote areas of South America, something, was to cut the foreskin of your victim in war and either eat it, or wear it as a trophy on a necklace. And by doing that, you actually said that you are absorbing the manhood of your opponent, or your befallen opponent, and now you add his manhood to yours, which means that you are now double the potential foe to your next enemy. So in the ancient world, if you came with a lot of foreskins on your neck, you would be quite a formidable opponent. Now think what it meant to the ancient world to tackle a nation whose foreskin was already taken by God. That's a major theological statement that has practical ramifications. I've nothing to cut. And not only that, it was consumed by divinity. What kind of a God stands behind these people that took their foreskin? Now we have to think about these things also in the context of the ancient. I can give you many examples of that. Bichlal, the whole notion of manhood, is as probably you know, it saturates the ancient world and also saturates the biblical narrative. How do you say male in Hebrew? Zachar, which means what?
Remember.
Yeah, the etymology of Zachar is remember. He is the actual witness of God's creation. By the fact that he is a male, he is, like, as it were, a replica of divinity. The Nekeva is called Nekeva because of something very particular that identifies her, and that's the hole or the Nekev in her body. The Zachar is something much, much, much bigger. And the whole idea of the male being a witness to the act of creation is seen also in the Torah. For example, we have two examples in the Torah where both in the case of Abraham and in the case of Isaac, where both of them ask their minions, one of them is a slave, the other one is a son, and say to them the following fantastic statement. They said to them, put your hand under my thigh and give me your oath, which basically meant, put your hand next to my genitals to create a bond between us and give me an oath. Now, this idea is also deeply rooted in the ancient world. I don't know if you know, but in the Roman Empire, if somebody wanted, first of all, witnesses could be only males. Sounds familiar? Also in the Bible, only two males can be witnesses. And when Roman witnesses came to witness, they would take off their pants and hold and give witness as a sign of virility and authenticity. This is why the Latin word or the Greek word testis, which means this, comes to testicles and testify. They come from the same etymological root. Okay. So there are many, many examples of that.
Wow.
Okay. All right, let's continue. We're good? We can get dressed again and continue?
Yes.
All right. So now we have to ask ourselves, where does the notion of the Messiah come from? And let's be psychologists for a second. What do you think? Who needs a Messiah in the context that you understand the Messiah? That's an assumption. I can tell you you're wrong just because I know for myself that I don't. So it can't be everybody. It can be everybody but me. But a lot of people need a Messiah. And why?
Who needs a Messiah?
Who needs a Messiah?
Someone who's dead.
Huh? Someone who's dead? I'm okay. Why would someone who's dead need a Messiah?
Because they bring them back to life.
Ah, so the Messiah is a miracle worker or something. Okay.
Messiah is someone you need when you are in trouble.
Ah, okay. So what is? Let's now unpack that term for a little bit. What is a Messiah? From the way you understand
it.
A savior. One word. What else?
A deliverer.
Another word. What else?
A
redeemer, good word. Now, what else?
Or it sounds like Christ.
We'll get to that in a minute.
No,
mamashlo. What else?
Yeah,
redeemer, what did you say? Savior, what was said there? What was the word?
Deliverer.
Anything else?
He also ushers in the end.
He's what?
He
He ushers the end. So there's something about a Messiah or the Messiah that is utopian in nature, but can also be a revolving door. In other words, the end of one era and the beginning of, right? So the end of one, which is ultimately the beginning of another era. It depends
on better era.
So now
one that's supposed to be better.
So we'll, what else? What else? What else? Guys, you forgot a warrior, mighty one, to vanquish everybody who stands in his way. He has to be just. He's a man.
Well, we don't want to make it impossible.
Well, no, we don't know.
Well, he's the Messiah. Don't worry about him.
We don't know those things.
Yes, we do. I'll show you in the text. Okay. Absolutely.
We don't know yet.
Well, it's not a text I wrote.
To,
okay, so he's a peacemaker, right? Who is he? Now I ask you the most, not who by name. Who is he? Don't tell me a descendant of David. That's not what I... Who is he? Where does he come from?
God.
He's what?
God's representative.
Okay. God's representative on earth.
But from within the people.
Yeah. But what?
From within the people.
Whoa, 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 wait. You're mixing now. Can I erase this? You're good?
I mean, the concept wasn't that he was an angel that came down from heaven.
Whose concept?
The Jewish concept.
Well, you'll see, first of all, I hope you understand right from the get-go that there is more than one Jewish concept. And that's what I'm trying to show you. But guys, when we're talking about the Messiah, we are not clear about the positioning of this entity within the earthly or the divine. There is a level of ambiguity that is inherent to the identity of the Messiah. And that, at that point, has nothing to do with the Messiahs that I talked to you about from the biblical monarchies. Because then, without exception, there were not only human beings, not only mortals, or even human beings who the Bible criticizes quite heavily. I mean, Shaul was a Mashiach. He was a Melech Mashiach. And look at him. Okay? So we're talking about something else. The term Mashiach is now actually appropriated from the earthly to the semi-divine or the altogether divine. And let's see what happens here. If this is the line between the earthly and the divine, we have no objection to the fact that all the kings of Israel, all the prophets of Israel, unlike sometimes other prophets in other cultures, and all the Kohanim of Israel, all of these people that negotiate God and mankind, they come from which realm?
Human.
They come from here. Right? Anyone wants to argue with that? No. We all know that they come from here. Even Moses, who is called the master of all prophets, the one who saw God, panim el panim, whatever that means, he dies on earth, he doesn't get to the land, his burial place is unknown, but he's a human very much, so makes errors, he's getting that, right? Nobody claims that he's anything but earthly. The notion of the Messiah is in many ways a projection, and here comes the combat, here comes the beginning of the deviation. The Messiah is very much a projection of human disbelief in its own ability to redeem itself. We'll see in a minute if we do. But the reason I asked all those questions, and by the way, the trail I'm taking you on right now, those of you who are quick enough could say to me, Zohar, that what you just said leads to some sort of a Nietzschean philosophy. It's almost God is dead kind of thing, that the Messiah is dead kind of thing. I don't need the Messiah in order to vindicate my own life. Well, that's not where I'm going. What I'm saying is, we are going to take a journey today that kind of looks again at the concept and may see that even in ancient sources, we find those two models side by side, and that the Jewish tradition, for the most part, had opted for the second model rather than the first one. And that the deviation between the two happened sometime around the destruction of the Second Temple, and that is in the advent of early Judaism, or early Rabbinic Judaism, which equals, in time and space, to the nascent birth of Christianity. Why? Because we can find in the same biblical texts both versions side by side, and I'll show them to you. One that claims that there is a Messiah that can be identified as a form of a man, but exhibits divine attributes. In other words, someone, like you said, who came from here to here, whereas other texts who come and say, no. There isn't such a thing at all in our mindset. A man is a man is a man is a man. And my friends, if you know a little bit about the New Testament and about the inner arguments of the very language that was used in the New Testament, do not take lightly the fact that there was a major discussion between early Christian scholars until the 4th century whether Jesus Christ should be called the Son of God or the Son of Men. And both versions appear. And this is one of the reasons. Because what happened here in early Christianity was the very center of the combat of two schools of thought. Can there be a divinity in the form of man coming to earth? Or is man always a man with all the foibles, all the problems, and basically he gives a divine message? In other words, we're talking about the distinction between the message and the messenger. In Judaism, there is always a distinction. Vayomar Moshe etvar Elohim le'emor. And Moses said the word of God. Ta 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 ta. In Christianity, Jesus now introduced himself, I am the word. In other words, there is no distinction between the message and its embodiment in human form.
But that was done after he died.
Hmm?
That was done after he died.
Yeah, of course.
He did not claim himself to be...
We don't know. We don't know, because the same thing you can say about Moses and about anybody else. We don't know whether they claimed it or not. What is important for us to understand, that this is the way that Jesus is understood in Christian collective memory, in what? I am the Word. And this is the way he's taught. I mean, in other words, that when divinity now comes to earth, cloaked in human form, in many ways, it is now the divinity and the word that the divinity says is one and the same. I am the message. I'm not just the messenger.
I have a question. The concept of the Messiah in Judaism, whether you think it should be attributed to a model like Jesus, who was considered divine and came to earth, what is the concept? I mean, if people are praying for the Messiah to come, and some people say he's coming on Friday, we have a Chabad people in my neighborhood who say, and there's a guy who every single Friday,
And by the way, he means it, and I'll explain to you also why. Because at the end of the second,
what does he think? Is he divine, or is he a man?
We'll see.
Okay.
We'll see. It's a great question. But guys, what's important for me that you understand the distinction here between the idea of a Messiah as a human and the idea of the Messiah as a divine cloaked in human form. Because if it is a divine cloaked in human form, it puts the authority on the advent of messianism on God. If it is a human, the whole nature of the discussion changes.
May I ask, in my ignorance, why I that the Messiah would be cloaked in human form.
Why you never heard that?
I never heard that concept.
Of a Messiah cloaked in human form? Let's get to the first text. Okay. Guys, you know what? Let me answer your question with the first text. You all have the text? Mm-hmm. Guys, let's look at Isaiah. By the way, the first one that I gave you from Samuel 24 and the are just places where you could look at the Torah, the Bible, and just see the term Mashiach. It's an anointed or chosen one. It's a king, just a king, without any of the what we talked about so far. Let's read together one of the most celebrated verses, which is actually the central verse that deals with the Messiah in certain Jewish circles. And that is from Isaiah, who, interestingly enough and not incidentally, is the most popular prophet in Christianity. And let's look at the first five verses and tell me what you see here. Who would like? There are some people who don't read Hebrew at all, right? I'm not criticizing. I'm just asking. Okay, so let's. I will read it in the Hebrew because I think it's important, and then one of you will read it in the English. Isaiah, Yudalef 11. Vayitzeh choter migeza Ishai, venetzer mishorashav Yifre. ונחה עליו רוח השם, רוח חוכמה ובינה, רוח עיצה וגבורה, רוח דעת ויראת השם. והריחו ביראת השם, ולא למראה עיניו ישפוט, ולא למשמע אוזניו יוכיח. ושפט בצדק דלים, והוכיח במישור לענבי ארץ, והיכה ארץ בשבט פיו, וברוח שפתיו ימית רשע. והיה צדק אזור מותניו, והאמונה אזור חלציו. Who would like to read in the English now? Don't be shy, guys. Go ahead. A shoot
will grow out of Jesse's rootstock. A bud will sprout from his roots. The Lord's Spirit will rest on him. A spirit that gives extraordinary wisdom. A spirit that provides the ability to execute plans. A spirit that produces absolute loyalty to the Lord. He will take delight in obeying the Lord. He will not judge by mere appearances or make decisions on the basis of hearsay. He will treat the poor fairly and make right decisions for the downtrodden on the earth. He will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth and order the wicked to be executed. Justice will be like a belt around his waist and integrity will be like a belt around his hips.
Okay. What do you think? What is Isaiah, who is Isaiah talking about? Actually, in this case, there is a lineage. It's quite a clear lineage, actually. It's not ambiguous, right? It is a descendant from the house of Ishai, which is the father of David. So we say Ben David, Mashiach Ben David, although if we want to be loyal to Isaiah, by the way, we should say Mashiach Ben Ishai. All right? It means here a man, a person who will be born out of the rootstock of Jesse, mishpacha, from the family of Ishai. Oh yeah, he calls him a man. What does it say about this man?
He will be loyal to God.
He will be
loyal to God.
Loyal to God for sure. What else? Okay, so what? Let's start now unpacking this, because what I want you to see here, that there is already here some sort of an ambiguity, whether this guy is completely earthly or is he enjoying divine grace to a level that we can no longer comprehend. This is why it was important for me to read in the Hebrew, because the Hebrew is even more nuanced than the English translation. But let's work with the English first. What does it say about this man? He's loyal to God. What else?
He's very smart.
He's obviously
very wise.
Even the word smart or wise does not pay justice. Yeah, he has some sort of divine wisdom, because how do we know that his wisdom is divine?
Because he has the ability to execute plans.
He has the ability.
Yes.
How does he judge? Look at verse 3.
Not by appearances.
He does not judge by appearances. לא למראה עיניו ישפוט ולא למשמע אוזניו יוכיח. He doesn't rely on human senses in order to pass judgment. He doesn't just what you tell him. He says, okay, I hear you, or you look very innocent. So he says, oh, he looks... No. If he doesn't judge you by appearances, he judges you by... Do you remember how God is sometimes described in the Bible? Bochen klayot valev. He who can inspect your inner... Yeah, he doesn't look at you, he looks at the inside. The same thing. There is something here about this Mashiach, right? That makes him uberhuman. At the very least, he's a superhuman. At the very most, he's already divine. There's someone here who enjoys divine endowment on a very radical level. But what does he do to the world? Does the world... Is this a utopia? How does he kill, by the way? How does he kill? How? No, not just ruthlessly, that's for sure. But how?
What is the rod of his mouth?
V'shafat adena, okay. V'ika eretz b'shevet piv. In other words, with his word, people vanquish with his word. The only one whose speech animates in the Torah is God. I don't know if it comes from here.
But the Hebrew sounds different in this case than the translation.
Usually it does.
No, v'ruach shpatav yamit rasha.
Okay.
And here rasha. It says he orders, he gives the order, but the here translate, it's making it sound like just by speaking.
That's exactly what it means. With the rod of his mouth, which means with the anger, the wrath of his mouth, he vanquishes his foe, right? And with the wind, with the blow of his lips, he kills the wicked. The man speaks to you, you should die, and you die.
But he can't be like the Christian Christ, because it's very clear that he's below God. Because here, it says, the Yirat Adonai.
Mm-hmm.
So he knows that he may be above humans, but he's below God.
What does Jesus Christ say on the crucifix in the moment before he dies? Eli, Eli, lama, why have you forsaken? He also talks to his father.
But if they're basing their theology on this, they say he is God.
No. She's right. It's more complicated than that, then, because we have the Trinity, of course, which makes it far, far more complicated. We won't get to that because there's a whole complexity to the evolution of monotheism within the Christian world. What I do want you to remember and see here is that according to Isaiah, first of all, the Messiah is a human being, but from the moment he is identified as a human being who has a specific lineage... And by the way, guys, I don't know if you know, but if you look, Christianity goes to great length to show that the house of David is connected to the house of Adam, and the house of Jesus is connected to the house of David. No contradiction. It's all a matter of narrative making. We all sin in that. What is important for me that you understand here is that right there is already an ambiguity. Are we talking about a man? Or are we talking about a demigod? Or are we talking about a man who was now elevated to a level of a demigod by the Spirit of God? Yeah, the Yud Hei Vav Hei. The Yud Hei Vav Hei has no meaning. No. I mean, there are translations that say it's also a verb, but you can definitely not understand it as such. The word Yud Hei Vav Hei, which many... Even more religious figures say Yud Kuf Vav Kuf and don't even say the name. That's why I said Hashem, the word that is untranslatable and doesn't have any meaning to it. And that in and of itself is its meaning, that it's beyond any kind of philological construction. Yeah.
I don't see the persuasive argument that the Messiah is some kind of demigod here. Because what the language implies is that he will be God-like, or imitatio Dei, which is a very revered concept in the biblical narrative, and that doesn't imply that he has powers beyond. I mean, there are extraordinary powers for a human being, but that doesn't mean that they're supernatural powers.
So when you read Ve'ika Eretz B'Shevet Pivu V'Ruach Sfatav Yamit Rasha, you don't see these as divine traits? I can show you verses from Jeremiah that speaks exactly the same way about God, and only about God.
No, I understand that, but that doesn't mean that the person we're talking about, or the entity we're talking about, is in fact God. He may only be like God in the sense that we also are like B'Tselem Elohim. So we're not God, we're just God-like.
I didn't say that this is God. I didn't say that he is God.
Well, you said demigod.
I said that he's of a higher divine order in relation to mankind. In other words, that he's now traversing somewhere ambiguously between this line and this line, and we're not sure where to put it.
What's the context? Why does Isaiah talk about this?
This is the utopian age. You'll see it in a minute when we move to the verses 6 to 11. This is the same chapter where it says, and a lion shall lie with a sheep, and ta-ta-ta-ta-ta, the famous verse of Isaiah 11, which we'll talk about in a minute. Let us move for a second to Jeremiah. Jeremiah also speaks about a utopian age, and he introduces another name for the Mashiach, which, by the way, all of you know, but you might not know where it comes from. So let me read to you from Jeremiah in the Hebrew, and then we'll read the English. Hinei yamim baim, that's already the beginning of a utopian age. Neum Adonai ve'akimoti leDavid tzemach. You remember the same? A shoot out of the house of David? Tzadik, umalach melech ve'iskil ve'asa mishpat u'tzdaka ba'aretz, beyamav tivasha Yehuda ve'Yisrael ishkon levetach, ve'ze shmo, asher ikreo Adonai, tzidkenu. How many terms have you heard? La'ad yavo Mashiach tzidkenu? Have you heard that term together? Mashiach tzidkenu? Tzidkenu is his name. Okay, Mashiach tzidkenu comes from Jeremiah 23. And look what he says, I the Lord promise that a new time will certainly come when I will raise up for them a righteous branch, a descendant of David. He will rule over them with wisdom and understanding and will do what is just and right in the land. And then he continue, and God will shall call him Tzidken. Okay? Now guys, from these two elements in Isaiah and in Jeremiah, what can we say about the situation in the land when the Messiah arrives? It's what?
It's not good.
It's not good. You're very polite.
It's in turmoil.
It's what?
It's in turmoil.
In other words, the Messiah arrives in order to do what?
Save.
Not just save. Look at the language. You're being very abstract. Let's start talking like prophets. What prophets are most concerned about?
To establish justice.
Order. To lift the poor. To humble the rich and the proud, right? Right? We talked about before in my other courses, we talked about tzedakah, the concept of tzedakah, not as charity, but rather as the application of social order in order to achieve some sort of a harmonious utility in the world.
But he talks also about Yehuda v'Yisrael.
Ishkenu. Ishkenu levetach.
Yeah, it doesn't say that there was a break. And it doesn't say that in the English. But that's...
We know it in the context here also, right? In other words, the Messiah arrives in order to put things back to normal again. Order again. Because the reality is chaotic. There's a lot of injustice. Guys, in order for a Messiah, v'shafat b'tzedek dalim, in order for a Messiah to treat the poor fairly, there must be poor. In order for a Messiah to make right decisions for the downtrodden of the earth, there must be people who are downtrodden on the earth. In order for him to strike the earth with the rod of his mouth and order the wicked to be executed, there must be people who are wicked here. There must be a lot of disarray in order for the Messiah to come and put it back together again. In other words, a Messiah is someone who arrives based on a divine decree and based on a human disorder, based on this kind of model.
But when there's always
this is why this is utopian, because we live in disorder and the Messiah is not here yet. Which now begs the most important question. If a Messiah, or the Messiah is supposed to come, and pardon my language again, I'm saying it for the recording.
Should have been here last
week. If the Messiah should arrive when things are shitty, he should be here from the moment creation was done. He should follow suit. I mean, it's never been okay to begin with.
Well, for the moment of the expulsion, not from creation.
Before. No! My friend!
1 hour.
You remember when you were in my class about the prophets? Okay, go back to the recordings. I told you, I remember it distinctly, that a prophet who appears on earth is an oh shit moment for the people who see him. Because you never find a prophet in the Bible that comes and says, "Hi, my name is Isaiah. God talked to me and I want to tell you the guys are doing great. See you later."
Yeah, but he's not a prophet. Prophets we have, lots of them. So that's why do we need somebody who's like a super duper prophet?
Ah, excellent question. Fantastic question. So now begs the most profound question. If we see that throughout our history, things are never in order. Guys, if things were in order, the Bible will have 19 books less. All the prophets that we read, they are always there because something doesn't work. They talk all the time about injustice and about this and about that and about that. We talked about that. They come in order to put things back in order again. They're human beings. Nobody ever discusses about the property of a prophet. A Messiah already has something else to it. It seems as if it's a prophet on Prozac. It seems like it's a generation 3 in the phones, the iPhone, what do you call it? Third generation? It's a third generation prophet. It's like somebody who is now upgraded to a different level. And that upgrade will find the Jewish people at a certain point where they will feel uncomfortable with their own model. Because what happens here is that the prophet or the Messiah presents the greatest paradox of them all. And that is the paradox of realization. A Messiah is a Messiah as long as he doesn't show up. Once he shows up, it's a new ballgame. And we have that example, by the way, throughout history, not just with Jesus. Okay, so we're now going to revisit a different model that will become much more prominent also in Jewish thought.
Is the implication here that divinity and us as part of divinity and God, the concept of God itself, is evolutionary, is potential, is developing, and it's not like either or, this is it, boom.
No, I'll try to show you eventually that the there is some sort of a mix of the two, models, and that it's far more complicated than meets the eye. In other words, that the Messiah as a figure is something that is least bothering to the Jewish scholars, and that the Messianic era is a far, far more important question for them, because without that, they know that a Messiah, whoever he may be, will never show up. And that's why what I want to do in the second hour is show you how Jewish thought actually does not allow the first model to evolve because it presents a profound excuse for mankind rather than a redemptive recipe. I can be shitty, I can do that. When the Messiah comes, he will put things back to order again. No. In other words...
Christians have a second coming because it didn't solve it.
Oh. All right, let's take... There's a joke... There's a joke that tells a story that God decided to come down to earth dressed as a human to see if people still believe in him and remember him and do what is right and what is just and blah 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 blah. And he walks around the streets of Tel Aviv, and nobody recognizes him, nobody talks about him. He's distraught. He gets to the Namal Yafo, to the Yafo port, and he sees a fisherman busy with his nets, getting ready to go to sea. They start talking, and of course he doesn't tell the fisherman who he is. And he likes that fisherman, nice old guy, seems to be a gentle person. And the fisherman says to him, would you like to join me on my fishing excursion for tonight? He says, yeah, why not? They go on the boat, they get to the middle of the sea, they kind of put their rods in the sea, and they start talking, and in the middle, all of a sudden, the fisherman takes out a joint, lights it up, takes a puff, gives to God takes, and then joins. They start talking, things free up a little bit, and then in the middle of the night, kind of, you know, it's kind of, it's intimate, it's nice. God looks at this guy and says to him, I have to tell you something. I'm God. So the fisherman looks at him and says, I knew this shit is good. Now the reason I said that is because in a Jewish mindset, it would be a joke. Because God doesn't come down to earth disguised. And there is a very different view of what it means to come to that point of divine realization. And here I want us to see, to look at the very continuum of Isaiah's prophecy. We started with something that raised a number of serious questions. And now I want you to look at Isaiah from verses 6 to 9. And we'll see what does Isaiah say. Remember, he said before that there will be somebody who comes out of the lineage of Ishai, and he will be a very wise person, he will do this and he will do that. He's going to be a very, very identified person who has at least raises a question about his powers and what he's capable of doing, and he seems to deliver the world out of his wickedness. And let's see what Isaiah says at verses 6 to 9. I'll read in the Hebrew and then someone will read in the English. V'gar ze'ev im keves, v'namer im gdi irbatz, v'egel uchfir umri yachdav, v'nar katon nohek bam. Ufara ודוב תראינה יחדיו, ירבוצו ילדיהן ואריה, כבקר יאכל תבן. ושעשה יונק על חור פתן ועל מאורת צפעוני, גמול ידו הדה. לא יראו ולא ישחיתו בכל הר קודשי, כי מלאה הארץ דעה את אדוני כמים לים מכסים. All right, this is the Hebrew. We'd like to read in the English. And I'm already telling you the translation here is, as Chaim Nachman Bialik once said about translation, he said to read the Bible in any other language but Hebrew is like kissing a bride under the canopy through her veil. So bear that in mind. All right.
A wolf will reside with a lamb and a leopard and will lie down with a young goat. An ox and a young lion will graze together. A small child leads them along.
So far, so good.
A cow and a bear will graze together. The young will lie down together. A lion, like an ox, will eat straw. A baby will play over the hole of a snake, over the nest of a serpent. An infant will put his hand. They will no longer injure or destroy on my entire royal mountain, for there will be universal submission to the Lord's sovereignty, just as the waters completely cover the sea.
Okay. I'll just make a little correction here. Ki mala aretz de'a et Adonai is not submission to my sovereignty, ela knowledge of me or knowledge of my sovereignty. Kemaim le'yam mechasim. What do we see here that is very different than what we saw in the first verses? What kind of a reality are we talking about here?
A utopia.
This is complete utopia. This is complete utopia. We cannot even imagine it, right? What else?
Taking away the concept of a serpent and the apple, by the fact that the child will sit that's the life of Salvatore. In other words, the sting of the snake is taken away by the Messiah's coming.
Okay, what is he trying to describe here? I think that the serpent and everything else here is some sort of natural symbolism. What do you think it suggests?
A perfect balance.
A perfect balance. What else?
But it's not perfect, because
the
wolf eats a lamb.
No,
it's an imperfect.
Uh-huh.
But the imperfect becomes acceptable.
Well, it seems to suggest here at least that all predators will be rendered vegetarians at this point, because a lion, like an ox, will eat straw. So I guess it affects also
the nature of them.
But or what?
The nature.
Okay.
Paradise speaking.
Okay, we're talking about an utter change of the natural order. This is a world we cannot even comprehend. We don't know what it means for a lion to lie down with them. But the most important thing for us is, what does Isaiah say at the end? What is the key success of that Messiah that we heard about in verse number 1? Kimala aretz de'a et Adonai kemaim leyam mechasim. What do you read here?
If it's not universal submission, it's universal recognition.
Universal recognition, universal knowledge, de'a, understanding, acknowledgement
of God's sovereignty.
But who is? What is happening here in terms of the relationship between men and God? What does it say? Who is here? Wait, you're jumping ahead. First of all, I want us to understand, where is Isaiah leading us? Part of this utopian world that Isaiah is talking about, that is apparently led by some sort of a Messiah, his end result is what? It's not the leopard and the lion, and that's not the issue. Again, the word submission is problematic, but knowledge of God, by whom?
By everything.
By whom?
By everything.
By every?
Every creature.
By every creature. By every creature. In other words, the realization of the Messiah is not the doing of the Messiah. They don't.
You can have both.
We'll see in a minute.
The realization of the Messiah is what?
Is not the doing of the Messiah. Because obviously the Messiah was judging the wicked who did not recognize him. He was killing them, the evil. He was doing a lot of stuff. But eventually the Messiah is realizing the world not as a human being. He doesn't say, and he shall rule over all of them, and he shall become the ultimate king. What does it say? Guys, what I'm trying to ask you is, if you actually read verse 1 to 9, somewhere along the way we're losing the Messiah. He ruled and he did and this, but ultimately he's dissolved into human consciousness. The whole universe will recognize God, not him. He's not mentioned anymore. He appears with all of his glory, and he just vanishes. He vanishes into...
He does his work.
It's not that he does his work and something happens. His work, as it were, is that thing that happens. The Messiah dissolves into a messianic era. He dissolves into the collective consciousness of those he affects. Now I want to take you to even a more radical rendition in the Bible. Let's go to the book of Yoel. One of the 13, one of the 12 smaller prophets. And look what Yoel says about this utopian era. And Yoel here is mamash clear on this kind of notion. Let me read in the Hebrew. Vayach reichen. Remember what Isaiah said about the Messiah in Isaiah in the verse, Vayatzach Oter Migeza Ishai, right? Look at verse 2 At the first one, when we talked about, what does it say? V'nacha alav ruach Adonai, nachon? The Lord's Spirit will rest on him, remember? Look at this one in Yoel. V'haya achreichen, eshpoch et ruchi, I shall pour my soul al kol basar, v'nib'u bneichem, uvnoteichem, zikneichem, חלומות יחלומון, בחוריכם חזיונות יראו, וגם על העבדים ועל השפחות. בימים ההמה אשפוך את רוחי, ונתתי מופתים בשמיים ובארץ דם ואש ותמרות עשן, והשמש יהפך לחושך, והירח לדם לפני בו יום אדוני הגדול והנורא, והיה כל אשר יקרא בשם אדוני ימלט, כי בהר ציון ובירושלים תהיה פלטה, כאשר אמר אדוני בשרידים אשר השם קורא. Now let's read it in English, because this is really a very radical prophetic rendition of this kind of a utopian era. Who would like to read?
And it shall come to pass afterward that I will pour out my spirit upon all flesh, and your sons and your daughters shall prophesy, your old men shall dream dreams, your young men shall see visions. And also upon the servants and upon the handmaids in those days will I pour out my spirit. I will show wonders in the heavens and in the earth, blood and fire and pillars of smoke. The sun shall be turned into darkness and the moon into blood before the great and terrible day of the Lord come.
All right.
And it shall come to pass that whosoever shall call on the name of the Lord shall be delivered. For in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem there shall be those that escape, as the Lord hath said, and among the remnant those whom the Lord shall call.
All right. First of all, now you understand why there is this traditional belief that when the Messiah comes, those who are buried closest to the temple will resurrect first. It comes from this verse. But guys, what do we read here? What is Yoel, a prophet, telling us? What will happen in that utopian era?
Everything will be destroyed.
First of all, we see two things that are similar between the two prophets. First of all, the utopian era is an era where things are taken out of their orderly manner, and we see basically a miracle, right? If here we have a lion and a serpent and a kid, here we have a sun that shuts off and a moon that turns into blood, blah, blah, blah. Things that aim to shock you and tell you whatever you're used to is not happening. But for the purpose of our discussion, what happens here in terms of that consciousness? Who is the prophet? Who is the deliverer? Who is the... Guys, it's not a trick question. I shall pour my spirit on all flesh.
God.
It says. And it shall come to pass afterward that I will pour out my spirit upon all flesh. Juxtapose with. A shoot will grow out of Jesse's rootstock. A bud will sprout out his roots. The Lord's spirit will rest on him. And here will rest on all flesh. Right? All my sons and your daughters shall prophesy. Your old men shall dream dreams. Your young men shall see visions. And also upon the servants and upon the handmaids.
So it doesn't mention a Messiah.
What does it mention?
If humanity is a whole.
Where is there a Messiah in the book of Joel? Show me a Messiah here.
He's not specific. But he's not specific about God either.
What do you mean?
It's how we interpret it.
How do you interpret? And it shall come to pass.
It shall come to pass afterward that I will pour. Who's I?
Oh, that's God. In Yoel, it's
okay.
God. Yeah.
So
no. Well, what I'm trying to understand from what you're saying, that's a different question. Whether it matters or not is a different question. So I will answer what you said by two things. First of all, there is a profound difference between the first one and the third one in terms of the redemptive authority. On whom lies the redemptive authority? On a Messiah from the root, the shoots of Jesse, or on all flesh? If you read Isaiah, It seems to suggest that humanity should await the coming of a Messiah that will arrive based on a divine decree.
Don't we have to wait for all three of them?
Not necessarily, because you'll see that there are those who now come and say, and that's where I want to take us, that actually the authority on the Messiah lies on men, rather than the authority on men lies on the Messiah.
What periods are we talking about of each one of these prophets?
We are talking...
What's the difference in time? I mean, things happen historically with the different...
I don't think that things happened historically as much as the concept of the inherent relationship between mankind and God, and let alone the people of Israel and God, is becoming much more prevalent. In other words, that there is the danger of losing sight of the human responsibility for redemption if one takes the notion of the Messiah as the Redeemer in whom lies the authority to redeem the world.
In other words, we're taking ourselves out of the mix.
Exactly. In other words, and what Yoel does here is actually saying part of the utopian era is that ability of global human consciousness, which is in and of itself a messianic era. Precisely. But what you're saying now is part of the Jewish learning which has evolved until you came to learn it. What I'm trying to show you is that evolution is not clear-cut. Judaism never had one clear model of a Messiah.
So in other words, we've been lost all along the way.
It's not that we've been lost. It's that
our consciousness has been raised all along the way.
It's not that we've been lost. By the way, Maimonides himself is very uncomfortable with the notion of a Messiah. And one of the reasons he's uncomfortable with the notion of a Messiah is because he's afraid that this notion of a Messiah, you will take yourself out of the equation and you will omit responsibility for the redemption of the world. To, you know what? I can kill you when the Messiah comes, then we'll deal with it. I can do whatever I do, when the Messiah comes, he will redeem me. Some haven't, some haven't. No?
In general, in the world today, there is less, less personal responsibility.
I'm not sure, and I'll tell you why. I think that first of all, there have been a number of movements throughout history who tried to, and also within classical Judaism, but even beyond classical Judaism, there have been movements that tried to regain a hold or to regain a grasp of human responsibility over the trajectory of the world. I'll give you an example, by the way. You're American, right? The founding fathers were, there are many who claim that they were atheists. I think it's dead wrong. They were not atheists. They were deists. They were deists. And deism is a form of a theology. It's a theology, it's not a philosophy. It's a theology that basically comes and says that you are an inherent creation of God, that you know right from wrong by the fact that you are created by God, and therefore you don't need God to intervene in history once God has created men. In other words, since you are already created by God, God creates and goes out of the historical evolution of things. Now, deists do not believe in miracles. Deists do not believe in a booming voice that comes and says to Jefferson, you should now do this and this. Says, no, I don't need to hear God anymore.
You don't think they were practicing Christians?
Some of them were. But the point I'm trying to make is that in terms of regaining a hold over human responsibility, over the human agent, the American Declaration of Independence is one of the most brilliant documents in that light. And it is a document that had a major problem with theological Christian dogma. But it does not throw away God as a theological imperative alongside religion. What it comes and says, look, we accept God as the ultimate sovereign of right and wrong, giving us unalienable rights. And from this point on, it is up to us to uphold those rights. And by the way, the declaration continues. If a government doesn't do so, you should not throw away God, you should throw away the government. All right? So, the same thing, by the way, also happens with secularism. Secularism was another way to come and say, I do not need a God to tell me what is right and what is wrong, because I already can establish for myself. The same thing is the movement called rationalism. The same thing is the movement called atheism. Or humanism. All of these are philosophical, theological, anthropological movements who came and said, we aim to regain responsibility over the human trajectory. We don't need somebody from above to come and tell us. Classical Judaism does something a bit differently. It comes and says, we don't need God to intervene in history and tell us what to do, right or wrong, da da da. Remember, my dear, God never speaks to the people of Israel directly. It's quite mind-boggling. He always speaks through the intermediates of a man, of a human being. Why? Because it is far more important that you hear a message from me than to hear it from God. Why? Because it is this realm that matters. It is this realm that matters. This is why prophets are always human beings. This is why kings are always human beings. This is why messiahs are kings, and they're human beings, and they're subject to fault. All right? And they're not those demigods who are infallible, who cannot contradict themselves, who cannot err, who cannot pass judgment wrongly, and so on and so forth. What does Judaism do? It comes and says, no. There are at least two models at play here. There is a divine charge who can come to mankind through the intermediary agency of a man. That happened before with prophets. That happened before through Kohen Gadol. That happened before through a Messiah who's a king. It could happen again through this Huber Messiah, which is mentioned in Isaiah. But that Messiah is not a God. He's not the Son of God. He does not belong to the realm of divinity, but to the realm of man. And most importantly, he is an inspiration. Now listen very good to what I'm saying. He is not the one who is responsible for the redemption of the world, but rather he is the one who initiates that consciousness that cannot be realized unless you decide that you want it to be realized. In that respect now, when we read the book of Yoel, we now need to ask ourselves a very, very different question. Who is praying for who to come? Are we hoping for the Messiah to come? Or as I believe, the Messiah, quote unquote, sits somewhere and praying for us to come. When the Messiah talks to God, and I'm talking here now right metaphorically, of course, and God says to the Messiah, when is the world going to be redeemed? He says, Be'ezrat Hashem, they sing Mashiach, 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 I sing Adam, 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 ay, 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 ay. Maybe you will knock on my door so I can come. In other words, the Messiah will come when you decide that He will come. Which takes me back to what your friend from Chabad said.
What is the vision of Chabad?
Now the vision of Chabad is highly, highly problematic. Because in the vision of Chabad, it's a modern rendition of what we talked about all day. There are those in Chabad that will talk about precisely that, a messianic era. Don't forget that Chabad is, first of all, a movement that is highly based on the Hasidic movement, that is highly based on Lurianic Kabbalah from the 16th century mystical circles. The Agadah of Isaac Luria, who sits there and waiting for the Shabbat HaMalkah to come, and said, if every Jew would put tefillin now and say, my side, the Messiah will come now. But what does Isaac Luria say? He doesn't say, if I pray strongly now, I'm being Isaac Luria, the Ari HaKadosh, the Messiah will come. He said, no, it's not up to me. If you don't participate in this act, the era will not usher itself in. This is why, for example, the mystics of the 16th century, which is my fourth lecture, they were obsessed about communal participation. Because they realized that unless everybody does their bit, nothing will happen. Quite literally, nothing will happen on a cosmic level, on a national level. Chabad now comes and takes the two models. When Chabad speaks about take a Chabadnik who sits in the streets of Tel Aviv and tries to persuade you to put tefillin. Alright? If you came to him and said, I would like to put tefillin, but just for your sake, I want you to know that I'm a Buddhist. I don't know if he's polite, but in terms of the mitzvah, he would run away. Not because you are not nice or something. It is not for you, it is not your mitzvah to do this. To bring the Messiah from a Jewish perspective, the Jewish people as a collective need to do certain things and think in certain manners and align themselves with the divine charge. At the same time, Chabad also introduced an understanding of a Messiah, of a figure, which for many, many, many people, including myself, is highly, highly problematic. Because there is a certain level in Chabad that reveres a human. And that is, in my opinion, as Zohar, it is something that is that borders on a foreign sentiment to Jewish thought. In my opinion,
not only you're not the only one who feels that.
No, I'm not the only one, but I'm the one who's speaking now. So I want to make sure that whoever hears this understands that I'm talking only about myself, about the percept. So there is also, again, there is a combination of both elements. I think that the element of a Messiah or the Messiah is a much more romantic rendition than the rendition of a messianic era. The reason for which is that the messianic era ultimately resides with a much more Jewish context and concept of human responsibility. Because if you look at the evolution of Jewish texts, you see that for the most part the rabbis are not as interested and they're not as keen on discussing the afterworld and what will happen in the utopian era and what will happen when divinity now hovers over the world. Come say, guys, this is nice. This is good. We align with it. This is the question we should deal with all the time is what do we need to do now in order to... I think you're making certain assumptions. Look, I'll tell you something.
Well, they're not looking for any ways to change anything. What do you mean, how do you know?
The only thing we can speak about is ourselves. In other words, that's what changes. That's what changes.
But I see other people who are
It's irrelevant. What's relevant is if I'm changing. If I'm becoming more conscious
that's
and aware,
the theory, that's that if enough people
it's not a theory,
change,
it's real. It's
that
real.
But that's also
change.
Not relevant. What's relevant is what the rabbis or the thinkers, the Jewish thinkers, wanted. It doesn't matter what the way we acted. Well, of course, we weren't acting right throughout the generations, throughout the centuries. People were sinning. People were doing whatever. What's important here is the fact that Jewish thought wanted people to take responsibility by assuming God's mantle or whatever it was. It doesn't matter that, I mean, it's true, obviously, that people didn't want to change it because we didn't enter the Messianic era.
Well, here I actually wanted to add something. Because you said it beautifully, we haven't yet entered the Messianic era, and I would actually like to refute that. And suggest, actually, that we are entering the Messianic era every week on Shabbat. We're just not aware of it. In other words, just like we are talking about Kabbalat Shabbat, receiving the Sabbath, Which basically means, if you think about the term Kabbalat Shabbat, it actually means that you are entering into a certain level of consciousness that allows a special time to fulfill its potential. And then you engage during that time in an elevated perception of yourself, of your community. You sanctify that time and that space in order to be on a different level. By the way, that in and of itself, if executed properly, is a tiny messianic era. Because basically what we do, and we do it every week, everybody to their own degree, but the concept is right there. In other words, a Shabbat, if I borrow from Heschel, who called the Shabbat a cathedral in time, I would call the Shabbat a Mashiach in time. It's just that we never thought about it this way. The notion of looking at a certain time. Look, I'll give you an example. If you do Kabbalat Shabbat, I'm not talking just about the ritual, I'm talking about allowing yourself to accept, or you don't, the Shabbat will come, right? I mean, it will come. It will be the seventh day, and it will have 24 hours, and right? But it shall pass through you, unidentified as a Shabbat. It will pass through you as yet another day, right? It will never fulfill its potential as a Mashiach in time, because, not because it's not there, it's because you haven't allowed it to fulfill its potential, right? You can make exactly the same rule about the Mashiach. In other words, when I'm talking about a messianic era, I'm not talking about a potential that exists here and permeates the universe all the time, only awaiting your awareness to realize itself. To realize itself. You're only assuming, because of these kinds of renditions that talk about a cosmic level, our minds are set to think about a Messiah in a cosmic level or a national level. It's either everybody acknowledges him or not. But let me tell you, my dear, there are pockets in this world who've already achieved the Messianic era. There are people in this world who have already achieved, you remember the second model? A personal redemption that allows them to impact those around them. And by the way, when you say there are those around me that are comfortable with what they are, and blah, 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 allow me just to challenge your assumption here by saying that today in the 21st century, when I look at the technological advent, when I look at all the comfort that you're talking about that we have in this world, I don't see the human race, as a race that has made any significant step in terms of its significant. It has made some steps, but significant steps in terms of its moral development, in terms of its existential questions. No, the reason I'm saying this is because the challenges you are facing today and the way you perceive the world are no different than the challenges that were faced by the prophets and by the kings and by the Kohanim and by those who wrote about the Messiah.
Just the way we handle it.
We haven't changed that much. What I'm saying is that the Messiah is an eternal concept that will exist as long as there is a gap in the human condition between the real and the ideal.
Huh.
My dear, you are now... You are now speaking in the language of a prophet. No, my dear, you are speaking in the language of a prophet. You're doing this because you think a prophet was a big shot. There are no big shots, they're human beings. That's what I'm trying to remind you all the time. These are people who understood what it takes for a human being to fulfill their divine potential, and were plagued by ignorance and inability of humans to realize that that divine potential lies in them. That's why the idea of a Messiah is so dangerous. Yes, it's external, it is instigated by the divine, and it does not rely on human behavior. Quite the contrary.
What you're saying is also pretty scary for anyone who is a religious thinker, because what you're taking away is the control of religion within the group.
Why?
Because if it's your own journey that you need to make, you don't need a rabbi and you don't need someone to tell you what to do. Mm-hmm. It's very problematic what you're saying in a religious sense.
First of all, well, that's a religious structure and a religious social order. That's not a divine will. Now, you have to remember that when we talk about religion, we're talking about man-made constructions that aim to recreate man's world in such a way that it is a perpetual reminder of the divine charge. In other words, religion aims, at its core, to remind men all the time what their potential is and what they can become. And by the way, the backbone of all religion is morality. It's ethical behavior. It's ethical behavior. Mind you, look at the prophets. The prophets never claim you don't say the Shema Israel three times a day and you don't go to synagogue and you don't do this and you don't do this. You don't give to the poor. You manipulate the young, you do this, you cheat, you lie, you rape, you do all of these things that are moral. So religion is a structured social order that aims to lead you in an ethical path. Once you are led as a community in an ethical path, remember, a community is the accumulated is the accumulation of the individuals. If you don't do it and I don't do it, this community is lacking. Well, I think that here you're already taking us to the historical evolution of a Messiah. And here we can see that almost in every ancient civilization, there is some sort of a divine intervention from above that comes down to earth and does something right or put things in order and gives it. So, yeah, what you said about God is you're opening a huge discussion here, which I cannot open now. But again, when you say we don't need God for that, a religion without a God is an anthropological exercise. It's not a religion in that regard. What I call religion is a human construction that is based on a theological charge, or at least a perception of a theological charge. I just want to clarify. I'm not in disagreement with you. I will move on to say that if we had the time, maybe in another lecture, is to discuss the role of God in this, but that's a whole different structure. I just want, in summary, to say that basically, if we look at the evolution of this notion in Jewish thought, and here, of course, we touch just two or three preliminary sources, we can see that as romantic as the idea of a Messiah coming down to earth and leading humanity towards redemption, even in the biblical narrative, and definitely later on in the rabbinic narrative and classical texts and in the modern era, we find that the shift is more and more towards a messianic era that acknowledges the fact that redemption is in the hands of men. And in that respect, we can find, if we go back to the creation, revelation, redemption structure, we find that if man was created in the image of God, and that the creation of man is already the revelation of God within humanity, it means that the authority to redeem the human, and here we talk about redemption of the human, which means the consciousness that the man understands now that he's part of God. Now that it's a full circle where man acknowledges, wow, I was created in the image of God, what does that mean? And by doing that, aligning oneself with God's charge, and one of you here introduced the term Tikkun Olam, and actually creating now a world through the power vested in me by the divine that is in alignment with what now I believe is God's will on earth. And God's will on earth, by the way, is not God up there, I'm here. God's will on earth is the accumulated will of the humans on earth. This is why in many, many ways, I think that we can find throughout Jewish discourse that there is an attempt to shy away from the discussion about the Messiah and talk much more about what it takes of mankind to bring the Messiah over. Mm-hmm.